Good morning, Village. It's so good to be with you this morning. My name is Renji. I'm one of the pastors. If you are new to Village, again, welcome. This past week, Pastors Ken, Paul, Insel, and myself were down in Dallas at a conference that happens every 3 years. It's a conference centered on creating healthy multicultural communities that are able to engage and be a witness in our diverse and divided land. And so it was such a beautiful time. 3 years ago, the majority of our staff actually went together to be a part of this conference. And one of the things that we realized 3 years ago is that Village is such a unique and complicated and complex community because we're inviting so many different kinds of people. There are 35 different nationalities that are represented at Village. And on a Sunday morning, all of those cultures and communities collide together. But what we're trying to do is it's pretty amazing to see what God has done in the past, that this wasn't just something that is new, but for 20, 30 years, God has been working and growing this. And 3 years ago, we came as people who were sitting and listening. But this time, when the leaders heard that we were coming back, they invited us to have a participation in leading and training. And so Insel Kang had an opportunity to do a breakout session that was filled, and she did an amazing job. Dr. Paul Choi, one of the most brilliant minds, he is so amazing in articulating a multicultural vision and theology that he was able to be in a room with other church leaders and people who want to desire and to move on this. It was so amazing to see that. Pastor Ken also had the opportunity to speak at the plenary session and to come from a posture of learning and to share what his last year and a half has been like joining in our community. And so one of the things that when we get to go away for conferences like that, it grows an appreciation and a love for what God is doing in and through this community. So as one of your pastors, I'm so grateful that you are here. I'm so glad that you're a part of this journey as we grow and follow after Christ. One of the things that we did was we had to drive a rental car in Dallas. Everything is big in Dallas, everything. This is the small car that we got. Like, I don't drive big trucks. They wanted to give me a Chevy Tahoe, and I asked them for something smaller. So they gave me a bright red Jeep Wrangler. And so Insel and Paul and Ken were making fun of my parking skills. But as you can see, I got between the lines, at least and this time. So it was good to be out there. Please go ahead and turn in your Bibles to Luke chapter 7. Village is walking through a Bible in a year. We're calling it a year plus. We started in Genesis back in January, and we're making our way through. And when we got to the fall, we decided to slow down and over the school year, slow down and go through Luke and Acts. So throughout the rest of this school year, we're doing Luke and Acts. We find ourselves in Luke chapter 7. But what we've been trying to say each and every week is that if you're approaching the Gospel of Luke as just a bunch of stories regarding Jesus's life, you're missing what Luke is doing. Luke is intentionally writing a declaration of who Jesus is and the work that he has done. That Luke believes that Jesus is the Son of God who has come to rescue the world, and his death and resurrection demands something of every single human being for all time. That in his life and death and resurrection 2,000 years ago, it demanded something of them, and even today it demands something of us. So that when we go to these pages, we're being invited to be challenged and to be encouraged by these words. That when we come to these words, we're supposed to orient and adjust our lives based upon Jesus' teaching and what he is doing. And so what we find here is it's in this Sunday, this morning, we explore a fascinating story where two postures, where two systems are contrasted through two very different people as they interact with Jesus. And what we'll find is Jesus's deliberate actions and words are challenging not only the religious leaders of the past, but also those who follow after him today. So before we dive into Luke chapter 7, it's important that we remember where we're at in this story. In Luke chapter 4, Jesus is in his hometown. It's the beginning of his ministry, and he's preaching. He's reading the words of Isaiah in his home synagogue. And he quotes from a passage that says that he has come to set the prisoner and the poor free, to bring freedom and release. When he uses the term poor, he is referring to more than just people who don't have a lot of money. The term poor is a broader category. It refers to those who are on the outskirts of society, those who are not at the center. It can also refer to those of a lower class or outside of the religious systems. What Jesus is doing is he's trying to bring those people that were out on the margins into the center. And it's not that his gospel and his way is only for those. In fact, he engages with religious leaders. He engages with those who have wealth, who have power. But what he's saying is it's time to level the playing field. That he's wanting to bring those who have been forgotten, that have been pushed to the sides, to be at the center. And for those who have power, influence, and wealth, to use that for the bringing and raising up of others. That's what his message was. And as he goes around teaching, what we looked at last week in Luke chapter 6, Luke captures the essence of Jesus' teaching. Pastor Ken mentioned this last week. Jesus was a traveling teacher. And over 3 years of his ministry, going to different communities and teaching and going into different synagogues, Luke attempts to bring all of that teaching into one section, which is the Sermon on the Plain. And Jesus says, blessed are the poor, blessed are those who weep, blessed are the peacemaker. He tells his followers that they are to love their enemies and to bless those who persecute them. Jesus is creating a new kind of people, a new world order, a new system of living. He's calling and designing a people who are radically generous, people who are leading by serving, people who are marked by peacemaking and forgiveness, and reject religious hypocrisy. This teaching is welcoming to those who are on the margins, but it challenges those at the center. And at this time of his teaching, it starts bubbling up resistance and people who are pushing back. It begins to create controversy and resistance, especially among Israel's religious leaders. Jesus is hanging out with questionable people, and his ways are a threat to their religious traditions. So opposition is bubbling up. And in our story, what we have is this tension is colliding into one encounter. We find ourselves in the middle of this tension. Jesus' love and welcoming of others from the outside is colliding with the religious leaders and their powers. So let's start at Luke 7, verse 36, and listen to these words. One of the Pharisees asked him to eat with him, and he went into the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. And behold, a woman of the city who was a sinner, when she learned that he was reclining at the table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of ointment, and standing behind him at his feet, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears, and wiped them with the hair of her head, and kissed his feet, and anointed them with the ointment. Now when the Pharisee who had invited him and saw this, he said to himself, if this man were a prophet, he would have known who and what sort of woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner. Let's pause there. We know the name of this Pharisee by the next verse. His name is Simon. He is a Pharisee. He is a religious leader. And in Israel at this time, religious leaders were the top leaders of society. There were no separation between politics and religion. The religious leaders were the ones who were talking about the way in which society ought to operate. They were working within these systems, and they received this honor and influence within the community. Simon, this Pharisee, who is in the outskirts of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the center where the temple is. It's the religious center of the day. There are many religious leaders there. But Jesus and Simon are now in the area of Galilee. I had the opportunity to drive from Jerusalem. I was in Israel two weeks ago. We drove from Jerusalem all the way into the areas of Galilee. It took at least 2.5 hours on a bus to drive. So imagine the length, the separation. So here is Simon, this Pharisee, in this community. He's this religious leader. He is influencing and has an impact in this whole community. And he's the one who invites Jesus into his home. This would be like someone who has a lot of power and wealth, bringing someone to have the community engage with this teacher. And when we read this, we think maybe Simon is trying to figure out who Jesus is. Maybe he's trying to learn who this Jesus is. That's Simon. We are also introduced to a woman. So as Jesus is reclining at this table, the guest of this religious leader, this idea of reclining, back in Jesus's day, the tables were lower and there would be cushions on the ground. And you would sit on the floor and recline as you ate. That's the way you would do it. So your feet are out this way, you're reclining, you're leaning, and you're engaging in conversation around these tables, tables, as people are around this. And while he's doing this, a woman comes in. Now, how does Luke identify this woman? She's a woman of the city. Verse 37. To be a woman in the ancient Near East, to say it was difficult is softening it. Your status is directly related to your father or to your husband. So if your father has high status or your husband has high status, then you would have high status, but it would still be less than them. And your worth and your value in your community was based upon whether you could have children or not. If your family didn't have status, then you were actually viewed even worse than a slave. But based upon this story, we can surmise that this woman wasn't married. And we know this because of what she brings. She brings an alabaster jar of ointment. This jar isn't designed to be opened and closed. It's concealed. It's closed. When you open it by breaking it. This is a lot of money. And what this is typically done in the ancient Near East is this is used or reserved for your dowry. This is what you give when you're getting married. It's a large sum of money. So what we know is that she's unmarried and she's bringing this large, expensive bottle of ointment to Jesus. So she's unmarried woman, but she's also identified as a sinner. In the several verses, what we see is she's named as a sinner two times. One at the front, one at the end of what we read. She's a known sinner, a woman of the city. Everyone who knows her would know that she's a sinner. And what this means is that she's not supposed to be here. She's outside of whatever the religious standard is. That if you want to be interacting with the community and worshiping with them, these are the people you don't interact with. You stay away from them. If you want to go to synagogue, you stay away from her. So right away, she knows, and we know she doesn't belong. This is a religious leader's house. A sinner wouldn't be a part of this gathering. She knows she doesn't belong. She knows she isn't wanted in this house. So why in the world would she enter into this space knowing that there's going to be glares, knowing that there's going to be whispers, knowing that people are going to treat her as if she shouldn't be there? There must be a greater force than shame that is compelling her to come and engage with Jesus. And what we see from what happens is that it's love. Love is compelling her. Love is driving her. It's her love for Jesus. Somewhere along the way, she must have encountered this loving and grace-filled Jesus who welcomed her and accepted her. Somewhere along the way, we aren't told what that story is, but she risks everything to get to Jesus. And when she comes to him, and the realization that she's in the presence of Jesus, she's overwhelmed and begins to weep. Picture this. She comes in where all the whispers of people knowing who she is, and she comes and she sees Jesus, and she's overwhelmed with her emotions. Have you ever been in a situation where you have control of your faculties and in a moment, all of your control is gone and the only response is to weep? There's several times in my life that has happened. One of those times was when I was in college. There was a terrible car accident that my friends and I were in. The car was totaled. When you look at the pictures, it's amazing that my friends and I were alive. And so it was a pretty tremendous situation. We went to the ER and all that stuff, but all of us, other than a couple scrapes and bruises, we were okay. I remember the phone call that I had with my parents, letting them know, Mom and Dad, I wrecked the car. But I remember the grace and the love and the concern that my parents had. And all of this time, I didn't weep, I didn't cry. There was definitely fear or uncertainty. A couple of days later, I told my parents, you don't need to come visit me. Of course, as good mom and dad, they wanted to see me. And so they drove down 2 days later and knocked on my door, and I opened it. And in that moment, since the car accident, I had all of my faculties, but in that moment, seeing my mom and dad and seeing their desire to just embrace, I lost it. I couldn't say any words. And I began to weep, sob, and I embraced my parents and they embraced me. And it was in the safety and in the safety of their arms where I could just release all the anxiety and the pain of the last couple of days. I wonder if this is what is happening with her, that she comes with this intention to anoint Jesus, but being in his presence, she's overwhelmed by love and gratitude. And so she begins to weep. And it's not just a couple of tears. These tears are streaming down and they begin to wet Jesus's feet. And so what does she do? She is thrust down to the ground because she doesn't have anything else. And so she undoes her hair, which is unheard of in a Jewish culture. You cover your hair, but out of love and service and trying to clean up what she has caused on Jesus' feet, she takes her hair and she wipes his feet out of love. And in the midst of her crying, in the midst of her wiping, she breaks the jar and begins to anoint him. Think again about that jar, about this ointment. This expensive bottle, remember what it's for. It's for her dowry. It's for the hope of getting married. If her value and worth and status is directly related to the idea of getting married, what is she doing in this act? This is her future. It is her hope. It is her security. And she lays it. She gives it up to Jesus. So we talk about giving our lives to Jesus, but this woman literally gives her future and her hope to Jesus. To her, Jesus is more valuable than all of that. I hope we understand the gravity and the weight of this act. And again, think of the courage that it took for her to do this in a public setting. She was driven by love. This love is extravagant. It's outrageous. It's unheard of. And to some, it's offensive. To pour out an entire bottle of ointment, why would you do that? A woman doing this with a rabbi, a sinner, going to someone who is clean in a religious house? I remember speaking on this a couple of years back, but even the imagery, I want to share this story, even the imagery of this ointment breaking. Early in my married days, when my wife and I were getting used to one another's getting ready, we both were getting ready to go somewhere really nice. And so I got my nice clothes, my suit on. I was looking all sharp. And she was already ready downstairs. And I took my cologne and I went, tss, 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 tss. And then I walked downstairs looking all good. And she's like, whoa. And I'm like, I know I look good. And she's like, no, how much cologne did you put on? And I was like, dang, four squirts, you know? And she's like, Renji, just one squirt, just one squirt. And it's one of those things, right? It's humorous, but like, you know, like if you put a little bit too much cologne and you walk into an open room, you can smell it. It stings. You can smell it. It's offensive. This is an entire bottle of ointment. So even in the act, it's filling the room. And do we see this as a beautiful act of love, or is this offensive to us? Because to Simon, it was offensive. You aren't supposed to do this. You're breaking all the social norms, breaking all the religious rules, all the gender rules, and he begins to judge her, and not only her, he begins to judge Jesus for allowing it to happen. Jesus can't be anyone important if he would allow such a thing as this. Jesus should know. If he was a prophet, he would know. Jesus responds. Verse 40, and Jesus answering said to him, Simon, I have something to say to you. And he answered, say it, teacher. So remember, I love how Luke does this. Simon is thinking in his mind, if Jesus knew who this woman was, then he wouldn't allow this. He must not know, therefore he cannot be important. He's saying that in his mind. Jesus knows what Simon is thinking. So he demonstrates that he's a prophet and has knowledge by saying what Simon is thinking. And then in three sentences gives a powerful teaching. A certain moneylender has two debtors. One owed 500 denarii, the other 50. When they could not pay, he canceled the debt of both. Now, which of them will love him more? Three or four sentences, and Jesus' teaching are powerful. Some of you are wishing Renji could do that in four sentences, right? But it's amazing. Like, in four sentences, he brings it to the center. Which of them will love him more? Simon answered, the one, I suppose, for whom he canceled the larger debt. I love the hesitancy that Simon is responding with. The one, I suppose, for whom he canceled the larger debt. And Jesus said to him, you have judged rightly. Jesus gives this financial example, this measurement to help Simon help us and help us understand. It's a simple and profound parable. But what is Jesus getting at? What is he trying to reveal to Simon? Let's keep reading. Then turning toward the woman, he said to Simon, do you see this woman? I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she has wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but from the time I came in, she has not ceased to kiss my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with ointment. Therefore, I tell you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But he who is forgiven little loves little. Jesus, in his statement, steps in and protects this woman. He acts as a shield around her. He affirms and welcomes what she has done in front of the entire group. And then he reveals who is actually being offensive. It's actually Simon. See, in Jesus' day, there are customs that you're supposed to do when you honor a guest. Now, I don't know what it's like for you in your own home when you welcome someone into the house. But this comes to a real way in my own experience when I travel back home, back to my parents' home to India. So when I go to India, there are specific things that happen when people welcome you in. And when you're traveling and you're visiting all your family, you end up visiting 5 people in one day, and all of these things are supposed to happen in each and every time. So when you walk into the house, you remove your shoes as an honor to the people that you're entering into. Like, you do that. You leave where you've been walking the dirty of the street, and you go into their home. And then when you are greeted, they call it a kiss, but it's more so like this inhale. I call it the inhale. You, on one cheek, you touch cheeks, and you go, and the next cheek, you go over the other side, and you, right? And the more that you love, they love you, the more you do this back and forth. I never know how much time you're supposed to do it. So like, it's really good when they keep going on, and you're like, okay, I'm really loved here. And then you sit down. You sit down, and they bring in these cakes, these sweets, these nuts and spices and things like that, and something to drink. So when you do this 5 times in a row, this is what happens. But imagine the 5th time. Imagine if I were to go and no one greets me with a kiss. Imagine sitting down and no one gives me something to drink. There's no spread. Everyone in the community knows what you do in order to honor someone. So when you don't do that, you're dishonoring them. It's intentional. So now when we approach this and we read this, what is Simon's attitude towards Jesus? At every turn, he chooses not to honor Jesus. And Jesus calls it out in front of the group. For those of you who are in the shame honor society, this is like Jesus is doing something that's unheard of. Simon is the one who's acting offensive. What is actually driving Simon? It's judgment. He feels that he is above Jesus. He's the one who's going to evaluate. He's the one with authority and with the power. Jesus then looks up at the woman, verse 48, and he says to her, "Your sins are forgiven." Then those who were at the table with him began to say among themselves, "Who is this who even forgives sins?" And he said to the woman, "Your faith has saved you. Go in peace." In front of all who are gathered, Jesus forgives the woman of her sins. Now, this is something really powerful going on. She has not offended Jesus. So this forgiveness is not her. Jesus going, "I'm releasing of you of what you've done to me." He's declaring that whatever has been there that has separated her from worshiping is removed. He is declaring her clean and able to be a participant in worshiping with the community. This is reserved for the religious leader. This act, it's reserved for the religious structures. It goes all the way to the high priest. The high priest is the one who's supposed to be the representative of God to administer the forgiveness of the sins when it comes to the sacrifices. So when Jesus does this, he is actually taking the authority that Simon supposedly has and forgiving her. The story is more than just about Simon and this woman. It's about the power struggle between the religious systems and Jesus. This thread is bubbling up in Luke. This is the second time where someone notices who gives Jesus the right to forgive sins, and he does it again. So what you have building up here is this, there's a reason why Jesus stayed in Galilee, far from the Jewish system in Jerusalem and the temple. He is building up a new way, a new idea, and it's contrasting with the leaders of his day. This is a deliberate act of Jesus to attack the religious systems, the established religious systems. It's a critique on the business of religion versus the heart of religion. The business of religion turns things into habits, into motions. The business of religion uses faith for gaining power and status. It's learning how to play the role in order to climb the ladder. Think about the systems of the world. You want to have honor, glory, and status. Well, they're taking the same thing and applying it into the religious systems of their day. Do we have a tendency to do that in our own world and when we follow after Christ? Because the heart of religion is more humanity, more dignity, more honors to others. It is about sacrifice and generosity. It is hearing where people are coming from. It is understanding. It is making room for others. The heart of religion is hospitality. It's forgiveness. It's being compelled, driven, motivated by love. Therefore, I tell you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven. For she loved much, but he who is forgiven little loves little. If we leave this passage tempted to think that Jesus is calling us to measure out the ways in which we ought to be forgiven, then we miss the point. See, when we have a great understanding of the goodness, of the beauty, of the wonder of God, if this is a continuum, the glory and the wonder of God is over there. And we in sinful humanity is over here. We're all clumped together. When we look and keep our eyes on the beauty and the wonder and the majesty of God, what we realize is that we are actually close together. That every one of us needs to be forgiven much in order to be welcomed and to engage in this glorious and wonderful God. It's not about measuring it out. It's about if you are a follower of God, if you are a follower of Christ, what you will discover is that even at your best, your heart is fickle. Even in the times where you're doing the greatest, you're achieving the greatest success, there's still ways where you're insecure. Even when you're at your best, there's still a tendency to show favoritism or to judge others. There's still times where you don't show kindness, where you don't give grace, where you act out of impatience, where we act out of gentleness, without gentleness. If I'm truly honest with myself, even in the times where I'm the greatest, the most successful, I'm still lured and tempted to other things. The one who grows in his knowledge of God realizes that he is constantly in need of God's forgiveness and grace. It's not about measuring the difference of sin. It's realizing that I need to be forgiven much. And how does that show up in our lives? It's love. It shows up in love. What compels this woman to give everything, to lay everything at Jesus' feet? It's love. How does love show up in my life? How am I driven by love? How do I interact with others based upon love? Love brought her low. Love threw her down at Jesus' feet. Does love drive me to serve others? Does love push me down to raise others up? I want to show you an image, and I'm going to close with this story. This is a picture of the former mayor of Bethlehem, Vera Baboan. She is a Palestinian Christian born and raised in Bethlehem. She is the first female mayor in the city of Bethlehem. Bethlehem is an occupied territory of Israel, so it's not officially Israeli land, but they control it with their military. And it's such a complicated experience down there. They still have their own governments, but it's a significant struggle. And when you listen to her story, there's so much adversity from trying to provide education for that community, providing healthcare, even just providing running water consistently. So rising above this adversity, she became the first woman mayor of Bethlehem, serving from 2012 to 2017. And someone asked her in our group, what motivates her to still stay in Bethlehem and to serve there? And her answer was simple. She said it was love. Love for the Lord and love for the people of Bethlehem. She so deeply believes that Bethlehem is more than a city. It is a symbol and a message. In the place where the Prince of Peace was born, she has the desire to see peace and reconciliation happen there as a symbol for the world. So it is her love that compels her, where all of her contemporaries, where all of these people who have the ability when they're educated like she is to leave and to go somewhere else, she stays. It is love that drives her to serve. It is love in the face of so many obstacles. What compels us? What motivates us? Can we say it is love for Jesus? And if so, how does that show up in our lives? Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for your kindness and your goodness, that you are a God who welcomes us. Lord, I pray that as we sit and wrestle with this passage, I pray that we would continue to be challenged by this, that we would look in our hearts and in our lives and find the way in which love bubbles up. Lord, I pray that we would recognize our desperate need for you, that forgiveness is not simply a one-time thing and then we're set, but Lord, that we come to you daily, each and every moment, for your grace and your love to compel us and to propel us into this world, to show others your grace and forgiveness. Lord, we love you.